Last week we spoke about the body of soul and the soul of body. And basically, I think what we were attempting to reflect on were the boundaries of soul. Body, by definition, is a kind of boundary, a protection. And we were attempting to look at this boundary of soul, the body of soul. And what we discovered is that it has a limitless horizon. When we were looking at the soul of body, we were asking the question, what can all of our feelings in our body, or what can our body tell us about our soul, the condition of our soul, our finding, our losing soul, our cultivating soul? What even can our illnesses, our diseases, tell us about soul? Today, let me speak on living soulfully in the world. To live soulfully in the world. To be with soul or not to be with soul. That is at least one of the important questions we need to answer as we move through this world. To live soulfully is perhaps the greatest task of all men and women. All illness, as Thomas More has told us in his good book, The Care of the Soul, all illness is a telling that I have experienced a loss of soul here or a lack of soul there. To live well, on the other hand, is both to bring soul to and discovering soul in all of my experiences, whether they be painful or joyful. In this way, I bring depth, breadth, and height to all of my encounters with the world and with others. Perhaps there is no greater pain than that of superficiality in our lives, isn't it? Lack of meaning, lack of true celebration, the continuous sting of the false self, which is simply what? My disconnectedness with soulfulness. Recently, I was speaking with a client of mine who felt badly that she was ending her exams, and what she was used to was using and getting drunk after her exams. And so, of course, she didn't. But she felt really lousy about not being able to celebrate in this way. This is what I'm talking about. Unless we bring soulfulness to all of our experiences, we won't know how to do really anything well. In that sense of well, I don't mean perfectly, but I mean in the sense of wellness, doing things well. Celebrating well, sleeping well, walking well, standing well, conversing well, bringing depth, breadth, and height to all of our experiences is to live soulfully, perhaps. And then we understand even then how to celebrate. How to celebrate with bliss does not mean medicate. It doesn't mean to avoid life, but yet to enter life's fullness. If I am without soul, I will feel the compulsive need to control others. I will have no respect for the feelings of others. I will not have a clear sense of where I end The false self's lack of boundaries, its constant intruding upon the selves of others and allowance of others to intrude upon its own self, is a distortion of the truer infinite and boundarylessness of spirit. You see, I wonder whether or not when we lack boundaries, and last week I made the at least an attempt to define disease as the lack of respect of boundaries, at least from the perspective of soul or the perspective of self-identity or from the perspective of emotional health, the lack of respect for boundaries. Well, we just said, didn't we, that the body of soul is boundaryless. It's infinite. And I'm wondering whether at a certain level our lack of respect for boundaries is a kind of strange, distorted, perverted way of searching for soul, whereby we intrude upon the lives of another and allow another to intrude upon our life, is a kind of distorted in a perverted way of the path of soul, which is boundaryless, but it's a within boundarylessness. The withinness of things, to see all things in the world and even others as but a symbol, a reflection, an image of the many-faceted being and becoming character of God. But this is a truth of the fourth dimension, isn't it? The soul of things. It's a truth of the fourth dimension. It cannot be lived out in the physical plane without great wounding to others and ourselves. Thus the lack of respect for the boundary, if you will, of another thing or another person or even another place. If, as Novalis has told us, that the seat of the soul is where the inner world and the outer world meet, simply put, if we do not live soulfully, we will never reverence the world around us, do you see? We will never see the world around us as the many-faceted manifestation of spirit. And when we see the wounding world around us, or when we see the world and others wounding, these simply are the lost souls. These are folks who have disconnected. They've lost consciousness of the fourth dimension of soul. And I know that one of the greatest tragedies is that many of us were physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually violated. We were misguided by others early on who themselves were disconnected from their souls. And I know this is true. Early on, many of us lived in a world guided by those who were disconnected from their soulfulness. And so what did we do? We did as they. We began to live disconnected from our soul. And when this happens, I will hide my truth by deifying my ego. My ego is what, at this level, my wounded ego will be all of the sum total of masks which I use, those personas I use to protect my wounded self, my self that is without soul, my soullessness. All of those personas or masks must be useful to get by and survive in a world amongst others who have lost their souls too. Does that make sense? Hazrat Inayat Khan, the Sufi sage, defines the lost soul as all as lost souls, as all of those who have lost consciousness of their soul. All of those who have lost consciousness of their soul. So to lose consciousness of my soul means then I need to take on a persona, a mask, that protects myself, that little self, the false self, the wounded self, the self that is without soul. The double self, the false self, That wounded self that protects the insecure identity. What are some of the names of these false selves and masks? Well, the ones that I've experienced and been experiencing is, how about the good old boy? That's one of the good old boy false self one sees in the South. I don't know the spiritual roots of this good old boy veneer. But the good old boy is someone who gives a sense of being secure and knowing the language of the country. Peter, one of the apostles, was a good old boy. Right? But good old boys sell out their masters. Good old boys betray themselves. Now, maybe there are good old girls, too. I'm sure if there's a good old boy, there's a good old girl nearby. It's that, right, it's that kind of, we get along and we can kind of be chameleons, right? We can be whatever is necessary for the proper time and proper place. Another word, perhaps, maybe the con artist. The someone who betrays themselves constantly in order to get by in the world, to survive in the world, because they have lost their soul. It's so tragic. And with whom they will live are other lost souls. Because the person who has connected with their soul will always see through the good old boy and good old girl veneer. You know, even within ourselves, right? And that's the good news. If you have been a good old boy or a good old girl, once you connect with your soul, it doesn't work anymore, does it? I mean, it's almost as if now we want to be real. At whatever cost, we want to be real. Another mask would be the self-righteous crusader. All right? This false self mask looks pretty good, just like the good old boy and good old girl veneer. The self-righteous crusader. Pick your crusade. It could be a church. It could be even AIDS. It could working for some kind of cure or giving monies. It could be any kind of crusade. I might use to avoid that wounded self inside. Fragile self inside. And if I am a self-righteous crusader, will I respect anyone's boundaries? No. They knock on our doors a lot on Saturday. I told y'all a long time ago, I used to wait for those in hiding after I got my master's degree in theology. But I always lost. Because a self-righteous crusader has no respect for the boundaries of others or for the belief systems of others or for the, has no respect, does not have an open mind at all or an open heart at all, but is caught up, if you will, in the seductive nature of this persona of the self-righteous crusade. The victimizer is also a persona that we can put on. Every victim needs a victimizer, and every victimizer needs a victim. And we can put this persona on. And if we wear this mask, we will attract. If I am victimizer, I will attract victim. If I am victim, I will attract victimizer. So at another level, these personas, once we've learned to put them on, which mask the true self, we will attract. They have a lot of energy. And that's one thing I wanted to share with you today, the energy. That is around, that surrounds the mask. The energy that surrounds the persona or the role can be quite amazing. So like attracts like, even if it's its opposite. I know that might sound like a contradiction, but we're learning, aren't we? On the spiritual path, what is a seeming contradiction is actually a paradox. Right? But every victim needs the victimizer, and every victimizer needs the victim. The victim has no sense of boundaries and allows him to be intruded upon. The victimizer is always intrusive of boundaries. And of course, the victimizer can often be the good old boy or good old girl or the con artist. Consciously or even unconsciously. If I have survived in a certain way, I may be unconscious that I'm using this tool to get by, to survive. Someone recently asked me, is the con artist someone who's conscious of surviving in the world or manipulating others to get by, living by the principle of scarcity as opposed to the principle of abundance? And perhaps not. I think that con artists are often the most sincere people in the world. They can hold a presidential office, or at least vice presidential office. They can be ministers. They can be priests. They can be teachers. They can be doctors. Most often, they can be lawyers. They can be all sorts of folk. But what is at stake is survival as opposed to soulfulness. What's at stake is a kind of desperation. Because one really lacks belief in that core self, in that core essential goodness that we all possess. And if we have lost connection with this core goodness, this essential self, this essential soulfulness, we will do all we can to avoid our destiny. And our destiny is to live soulfully in this world. Our destiny is to eventually begin to question the unquestionable. Our destiny is to question the usefulness, the spiritual usefulness of our masks, and then begin to take on new personas. We always need personas and we need masks. But there are destructive ones and then there are healing ones. And so the point is to begin to take off the destructive masks, the destructive personas, which hide the fragile, wounded ego, and then to put on the masks, to put on the personas, the roles, if you will, that lead us to finding soul in everything that we do. And immediately when this happens, we become emotionally honest. Immediately when this happens, we begin to revere and respect the things of this world and others in this world. We begin to have a sense of boundaries, right? And we begin to descend into our self, our past. We begin to have memory, right? Once we begin to have memory and we can begin to grieve some of the losses, and even that sweetness of memory of those wonderful experiences, behind and next to all the painful memories are sweet ones as well that can never be reduplicated. And that's why they are so wonderful. And that's why it's so wonderful to be in this world and to be moving across this grand threshold, is because we will have experiences we can never duplicate. That's the holiness of being on this earth, isn't it? Is that we have experiences that we will never duplicate. And so, as we move through this world, we are gathering, if you will, memories. And those memories have something to tell us of the body of soul as well. They tell us of the grand parameters of soul which exist beyond this present moment, and yet use this present moment in such a sacred way, because this present moment is indeed sacred. Another masking self is the know-it-all. I know none of you have ever donned this mask. By the way, you can don a number of masks. As the more survival-oriented one is, the more externalized one is, the more one looks outside, you know, what can I do to avoid all pain at all costs, the more masks one will don, and the more artistic one will become in donning these masks.
Mask is? Donning these masks. The know-it-all. It's unfortunate in one way, I guess unfortunate in another, because most of these masks I've donned. But the know-it-all is one I know really well. I remember being, in fact, in my first philosophy class, I think my sophomore year in college, too many years ago, and I would raise my hand when the teacher would say something about his philosophy, which I knew nothing about, but it would raise my hand and I would argue vehemently and passionately. I would find something that I would be angry about and argue with this teacher. And he said, well, have you read this book? I don't need to read this book. I know it's true. Right? And what was I doing? I was so angry. And I said, well, actually, later on, I realized that, you know what? I was angry at my father. Every teacher that a student argues vehemently with, there's got to be father issues around the corner. And I had been wounded early on by the absent father. And so what I was wanting from this teacher is approval. What I was wanting from this teacher is acceptance. What I was wanting from this teacher is a handbook on how to live. What I was wanting from this teacher is a spiritual father. But I lacked trust, and so I had to become a know-it-all. Because by being a know-it-all, I would have this protective wall. So I could get angry with all the images of the father. And perhaps that's what the adolescent does. Correct? That's what the wounded adolescent does. That's what you ask an adolescent how they feel about their parents. And I mean, when the parents are out of the room, it's a whole different number, I'll tell you. Just came from last week. I was in another cottage with adolescents who were in recovery. And boy, when the parents are out of the room, it's an interesting thing. But when they're in the room, begin, they don the mask. How can I manipulate? How can I split? How can I triangulate? Et cetera, et cetera. They don't use those words, but boy, can they do it. Right? That's the nature of the wound and the nature of what will happen when we don these masks is there's always some kind of pain that I'm disconnected to. And so, you know, I remember as a student, I was so angry and so passionate, so really dedicated, wanting the truth. But had to be a know-it-all in order to protect myself. And eventually I met a teacher who was gentle and shrewd enough to love me into being open. You know, allowed me to have my say. Let me get angry. Let me pound my fist. And then finally I could cry and weep. And then say, okay, now are we ready to learn? Are we really ready to learn now? So when one, I think when a student does meet a compassionate teacher, when a student meets a teacher that allows one to go through all of those emotions and questions, then a student can then take off perhaps some of these hurtful masks. But many of us don't, perhaps, I know some of us have met these teachers, you know, who allow us, right, to be in our space and slowly, slowly grow. I find these the saints of my life, those that have allowed me to get in touch with the wound and not judged me, not made my world smaller. Those teachers that have not looked at me and said, you have to do it my way. You have to understand truth the way I'm telling you. But a teacher that will exemplify by their life, by their attitude, by their mood, by their gestures, and even not by their words, that they are authentic teachers. But the know-it-all is a teacher distorted. The know-it-all has, you know, is wanting a father or wanting a mother, you know, is wounded. Wounded in their soul. Disconnected from their soul. So maybe you can help me with these labels. What if you can look at some of these labels, these masks, personas, which you use in order to hide and protect your fragile self that is disconnected from soul, you have made great spiritual progress. If you can but name one, You have made great spiritual progress. You've made great progress in connecting with your soul. These are but a few that I have located in my world, in myself. And it is amazing what grace can occur, can happen, when we allow ourselves to take the risk with another human being. We can't do it alone because it's too powerful, right? I take off the mask or I take off the persona that I've trusted in. I do that alone. What's going to happen? All sorts of fears will invade my psyche. They will invade the whole. I need always another person. And that's the power of the 12 steps. That's the power of all confession. That's the power of the great world religions that have always said, where there are two, there I am in the midst of them. In the healing, in the wholing. Recently, I opened the big book. And in fact, Chuck, I have to thank you for this. You had called me and asked me about the original six steps of the Oxford group. Well, I began searching. And some of those who were scholars of the big book had no clue. Of course, Big John Cornelius always comes through.
Well, Neil, didn't you know it's on page 292?
So I opened the book and I got to page 292 to see the original six steps. And the first step said complete deflation. Wow. I mean, that step developed in a pretty watered down statement, if you ask me. I am powerless over alcohol. Complete deflation of the ego, of the masks, of the personas. Complete deflation is the first step to these early pioneers. That's pretty powerful. Maybe we could look at it in terms of its usefulness to us. I think it's important sometimes to look again at the origins of things, you know, to see it again so that it can give us another hue, another color, if you will, another dimension that perhaps we've missed because we see the words constantly, right? We see the words constantly. And as poetry always makes language strange so that we can see another dimension of the familiar, perhaps this might be helpful. Complete deflation. Complete deflation, not of the healthy self, but complete deflation of the unhealthy ego. Are you with me? That has to occur for a first step. So actually, what we're saying, this first step of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is about a cultural revolution. It is about a cultural healing. It is about totally transforming ourselves. Utilizing, of course, the God of our understanding. Not being intruded upon, someone else saying what that God of understanding has to be like or look like. Yeah. But it's simply allowing ourselves to let one of those masks or personas, like a bubble, kind of deflate. And then maybe it falls off, and then we have something more real. A veil has fallen off, disconnecting myself from soul. The second step of this early Oxford group was dependence and guidance from a higher power. Period. Dependence and guidance from a higher power. Doesn't say what that higher power is, but it says dependence and guidance. That makes sense. Because if I'm going to allow these personas or these masks to come off, what am I? I'm going to need something that will contain me, that will support me, correct? And it has to be a positive higher power. And that positive higher power may even be a group process. Which reminds me, by the way, that William James' notion of soul was that it was a process, not a thing, but a process. Hazrat Inayat Khan calls soul a current and said that if we understood electricity, when science understands electricity, it will also understand the nature of soul. It is not a thing.
It is not an object. We've lost sight about what soul is. Complete dependence and guidance from a higher power, a current, if you will, a process of greater healing. The third step of the Oxford Group was moral inventory, which included character defects or personality traits, which they named as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentment. I've never had any of these. See, obviously, now we're getting close to what these masks are, aren't we? Or what we mask.
I'm not selfish. What do you mean, I'm not selfish? I'm not conceited. I'm not jealous. I'm not careless. I'm not intolerant. I don't have a bad temper. I'm not sarcastic. You are. And I'm not resentful. You see, so whatever I use to mask will always say no to the truth, because that's the fragileness within the self. And so that third step is very crucial, because it's a step of facing ourselves. But the 12-12 helps us. We look at the 12-12 at that, which is now the fourth step, moral inventory, says that we need to face ourselves, never losing sight of the positive and healing higher power. So we don't want to look just at the stuff, the fragile, wounded stuff, but never losing sight of that higher power that wishes to heal, to transform, and to really set us on our way, to connect us to soul. Because a being that is connected to his or her soul will never avoid the issues, will never avoid the world, will never avoid the unavoidable. So the moral inventory is actually just a look, taking the perception that is outward and then turning it around here, correct? As Carl Jung said in Modern Man's Search for a Soul. Once I begin to look within and see that it is my problem why I'm here in this planet, it is my problem, not your problem, then I begin to make soul. I get connected to my soul once again. If I keep saying it is your problem, it is your problem, I'm putting all of that focus out here and not here. The fourth step for the Oxford Group was confession, and then fifth, amends. And then lastly, continued work with other alcoholics. John Cornelius tells me that it used to be, before they wrote it in the book, not alcoholics, but sinners. Continued work with other sinners. I like that. Because what that does suggest is we are always kind of, we're never totally whole. You know, sin in the original notion, in terms of the Judeo-Christian notion, was separation from God, disconnectedness from God. So even though we move through all these steps, we continually work with other folk who are like ourselves, right? Once we begin being the self-righteous crusader, right, that we see in that neo-Nazi AA-dom, and in some forms of fundamentalist Christianity, and even in fundamentalist Buddhism and Hinduism, and even fundamentalist Native Americanism, we'll probably be having to even go there to do some taking a look. We realize that we are always working, always looking. But confession and amends, confession perhaps the sharing and making the amends, is perhaps all those times when I have lacked soul and did not bring soul into my experience, I apologize. So we kind of go back, don't we? We go back with our memory to heal those past moments where we can. The places where we did not bring soul into our experience. The place where I may have led someone and misguided someone, disrespected someone because I was disconnected from my soul. It becomes my job. We are all old souls, perhaps. And I like that definition of the old soul, person who hasn't quite learned from their experience. Yeah, where we have to go, it is our problem. And we begin to see that we have no blame anymore. And yet at the same time, we don't blame ourselves. We just realize that all of a sudden we land in this planet. Hazrat Inayat Khan says we land with a lot of information. We land with some information, some of us more blind than others, about this soulfulness. And we are constantly meeting against other beings who can tell us about where we wish to be in the nature of our soul. And that some of us, when we have memories, the deja vu experience, that means this is experience that we have in terms of our soul. And it's trying to make its way to our body, to our mind, and to our hearts. Hazrat Inayat Khan has a wonderful definition of soul that he gets from the Chinese philosophers. That soul is the accommodation of God. To accommodate God. And an image that he uses is the iris, the pupil of the eye that accommodates light. So when asked what the soul is like, Hazrat Inayat Khan answered, the soul is like the iris or the pupil of the eye because it accommodates. It is a space. It accommodates. Marie Rainer Rilke, my favorite poet, called the flower a muscle of infinite reception because of its ability to absorb light. The muscle of infinite reception. The mind, when it becomes accommodating, expands. Right? It accommodates new ideas. When the heart accommodates, it becomes generous. When the heart accommodates, it becomes compassionate. We've all had that feeling, haven't we? Where we've wanted our heart, all of us have had spiritual experiences where our heart, we wanted to, that heart expanded and it went from here to the end of the universe and back again. And we could embrace everyone. We've all had those moments where the heart accommodates. The heart needs to be generous in order to accommodate. Where we've gone out to another human being. Problem is, if we go out to another human being without soul, we will mess up. Right? Because I can go, oh, I want to help you. And someone goes, shut up, I don't need your help. We have to always respect boundaries. So you see, when the heart accommodates, it doesn't mean rescuing someone. It doesn't mean intruding upon boundaries. When the heart accommodates, it is about being compassionate. And to be compassionate simply means to be with others in their pain. It doesn't mean to rescue it. So as the mind accommodates new thought, so as the heart accommodates, by opening up itself and allowing its boundaries to expand, the soul accommodates God. That means that we need to become empty cups, open, in order to become transfigured. So that means that all of our masks we use to hide, right, our false self, all that energy we've been using to not reveal that false wounded self needs to be used to accommodate God who wants to be in the world. The God of your understanding, whatever it is. Einstein called God the principle of benevolence in nature. Einstein himself had a notion of God. The principle of benevolence in nature. The principle of
good, that wanted the good for the world. To accommodate God perhaps means to let go even of our images of who God is. Does that make sense? It means to be infinitely receptive as the flower is and the eye is to the light, to the sun. To become receptive. We lack the ability to do this in our culture. Right? Being receptive is like being vulnerable. Being open. We don't like that, do we? Because we've been victimized so often, right? By the one-sided, patriarchalized view of the world where so many men have abused those who were receptive. But we need to be receptive and follow the laws of boundary, the laws of reverence and respect. To be receptive to soul, right? To be receptive to the soulfulness of things. Not to be receptive to the destruction of things. Right? If we're receptive to the destructive character of the world, the shadow of soul, if you will, then that's when we become victims. So we are not to be receptive to the shadow of soul, but be receptive to God in all things. It's a wonderful image. It's a wonderful image. So the soul accommodates the many forms and manifestations of God in the world. Let me quote from Hazrat Inayat Khan to end our time. It is largeness of soul which will accommodate all experiences, not some, all experiences. And in the end will become God-conscious and all-embracing. The mystical way of being selfless is to realize the self by unveiling the self from its numberless covers which make the false self. Let us sit and bask and heal in this wondrous truth.